Hi everybody, Paul here with Next Day Q&A for Lab Elite members. This is our opportunity to whip through the material in another format in a different kind of a way so that you can have what the educational theorist calls spaced repetition, which means if the spaces are unpredictable and the repetition happens, particularly in a different format, then your chances of learning and metabolizing the material, I'm sure metabolizing is not the right word, but absorbing it and percolating on it and making it into your own are far greater because of that kind of format. So that's our reasoning behind that. To fit 4 or 5 hours into one or so means I'm going to rush right through it, but that's actually part of the process. So button down, hold on, and here we go. This was, in fact, one of our most exciting workshops simply because we've gone deeper at this level than on many other occasions. So it's a pretty exciting thing to look at. We're looking at the three big things that bring people undone in terms of how capably they deal with their own futures, their own lives, their relationships, those kind of things. And those things all have something in common, that is that our hearts get broken at one level or another, and our ability to repair those broken hearts is pretty minimal. So we're going to look at that as we go along. So as you would know, the heartbreakers are betrayal, abandonment, and trust. And the interesting thing about them is that you could lay them all over the top of each other and more or less say that they're the same thing. They have so many things in common, in fact, that many people feel like they are the same thing. It is definitely true that abandonment and betrayal, probably in 99% of cases, involve the breaking of a trust. Therefore, it's probably fair for us to say that, trust is kind of like the common thing underneath all of them. So trust is, or the broken trust shows up in abandonment and in betrayal, and in itself as well. So, they're an interesting group of things to put together. When we do put them together, then what we find is that most people don't do very well with that. They tend to kind of cycle around from one to the other in a vicious circle kind of arrangement. And perhaps a way to do it is to put them together in what some people call a Venn diagram. Has other all sorts of other names as well. But essentially, what we're saying is when these things start to overlap, which I was kind of talking about them doing that anyway, then essentially what's common to all of them is that broken heart in the middle. But what you can see is I've put some labels in there for the overlapping parts. And so when we say combine betrayal with the breaking of trust, then generally speaking, what we find at a high level, a high incidence level, is that people who've had that happen to them tend to be gullible or the opposite. They tend to be easily convinced about things or almost unable to be convinced about things. If you get trust and overlay it with abandonment, then the most likely response is you find people who are lost and unable to find their way forward. And when you get betrayal and combine it with abandonment, then you get people who turn cynical as adults. So there's an interesting kind of a thing when you get those things and say, well, if you put two of them together without the other one, what do you get? And they tend to be, they tend to show up in a way that you see them on the diagram there. So I'm going to do the unspeakable, and that is separate them out into three separate things and deal with one at a time. The thing that we should mention about that is that this is like cooking a casserole and then saying, tell me what the ingredients are. Because once they're all mixed up together, which is how they most commonly occur, then they have elements of each other showing up. So I'm going to pull them apart, even though that's probably not a realistic thing to do. But if we do it, we can get a handle on what we're dealing with. So when we look at betrayal, then what we have to do is go, okay, so what is it really? Well, it's the bond of trust being broken in some kind of a way that leaves us feeling like we don't know what's going on because it's not according to our expectations. So betrayal, somebody going behind your back, somebody telling stories about you, somebody actually, refusing to repay a loan or whatever version of that is, and probably the most common version of betrayal is infidelity, then for us, it's an action. So it's a thing which is done to us, and that makes it into an action. Therefore, oh, there's that expression there, done to us. It has that sense that we are a victim of it. You know, we can very much feel like the innocent bystander, and, you know, the common expression is, what did I do? You know, I didn't do anything wrong. That can extend itself into the medical field as well. And I remember when I got cancer in 2003, the very first thing that I said was, what did I ever do wrong that I got cancer? So, you know, it can be kind of like, you know, you would say life was betraying me in that case, or you could just go at the sheer bewilderment of, like, what, you know, we tend to personalize everything. And so in personalizing everything, you know, I got the cancer and I'm suddenly going, well, what have I done wrong? You know, who have I done damage to? Who have I harmed? That kind of a thing. So the feeling that it was done to us is the thing that makes us eventually feel powerless. If we don't feel it first up, then pretty soon down the track, what we're going to feel is powerless. And of course, you know, if this is a parent who failed to take care of us, or somebody who, you know, wasn't there, then we start to feel like we have no power over the situation. And when I say a parent who didn't turn up, you know, I mean that in the most general of senses. You know, my dad left the house at 7 a.m, got back at 7 p.m. He was a good, hardworking man. And as a consequence of that, I suffer from what they call the absent father syndrome, which was, you know, you couldn't point a finger at saying anything that he did wrong. In fact, he worked harder to bring more money home, to put more things on the table. And I do recall things being pointed out, like, you know, I work hard so we can have these extras. Then that left me out of the sphere of influence, so to speak. And so lots of us feel like there's nothing we can do about this. It's kind of like, beyond our control to, beyond our ability to feel like we can do anything about it. Of course, there are a whole bunch of possible emotions that are likely to surface as a consequence of betrayal. I'm just making a list here. It could be a much bigger list, a much shorter list, and you may suffer from some or none of these concepts. And everybody that you come across who's been betrayed is going to tell you a different story. So there's this kaleidoscope of emotions here. And I'm even going to say that they're going to show up like a kaleidoscope because we're all mixed in together and the images are all over the top of each other and we have trouble separating them. A lot of these emotions are actually all occurring at the same time, which makes us even more confused about what's going on. And that leaves us more in shock and less capable of figuring it out, particularly if we're 10 or 6 years old or whatever. There are some things that we can describe that are common instant reactions. So people have been betrayed sometimes just, you know, this is the bottom of, you know, to hurt back, so to speak, to lash out, so to speak. Sometimes it's just sheer outrage and hurt and indignation, sometimes dismay. Probably dismay is common. It's probably there 100% of the time. Very common that we start going searching for reasons why. And because it's almost as if we could find out why, then it's kind of like it didn't happen. Very often, naming and shaming takes place from the point of view of, I'm going to call you out, and maybe that's, you know, you'll realize how wrong you were when the rest of the world joins in and saying how bad you were. But, you know, very often what happens is that people feel lost. There's a lot of drifting and a lot of inaction and a lot of not knowing what to do, so to speak, in the instant kind of, this is within the first, you know, sort of the first few hours to days of a betrayal, then these things can persist. Of course, they can persist long-term as well. Would not be a surprise, and you shouldn't be surprised if you come across somebody who was betrayed 30 years ago and is still feeling some of these emotions as if the whole thing happened yesterday. So when I say these are instant things, don't assume that they automatically go away because time is passing. The other way to look at it is, okay, well, what about longer term reactions? Well, they do sometimes turn out to be a little bit different. There can be continued ruminating being the thinking process of going over it and going over it and going over it. In a way, it's kind of like trying to make sense of it, but it kind of leads us, you know, or leads some people in the direction of revenge or thoughts about revenge. Outrage can continue, as I said, forever. One of the consequences longer term is the realization, okay, then if I'm in less relationships, I get less abandoned. If I'm less open in those relationships, I get less abandoned. So that's kind of like a logical kind of, you know, reaction, so to speak. Some people go hard and their outer shell may actually become quite thick and penetrate all the way to the middle. the thicker that shell, then probably the longer the time or the more hurt that person is, really. That can lead to, or other things can lead to, the inability to commit again into a business relationship, a friendship, a marriage, or whatever. And it can even show up as, you know, like remaining private and quiet and introverted, not from the point of view of naturally being introverted, but from the point of view of not being exposed to any further hurt or damage, which we might call wariness. So I hope that that's not too unusual a word. I haven't seen wariness written in too many places. Mostly I do my spelling by recognizing a word. Wariness looks difficult to me to recognize. And maybe expectation disappointment. So you wouldn't have to travel too far in our world to come across somebody who expects things to go bad. And that's really a longer term reaction to initial betrayal. When we look at what is the core issue, then basically because betrayal has this characteristic about, you know, we were an innocent bystander, then it's highly likely that we assume the victim role in the situation. And there's not much choice about that because, you know, we quite often say to ourselves, well, what was I supposed to do? Which is, you know, it's a description of having no power to change anything. And, you know, because betrayal has this characteristic of us not seeing it coming, in other words, betrayal doesn't happen until it happens, so to speak. That might sound like I'm talking through my backside, but the reality is betrayal doesn't happen until it happens. And until it happens, well, we're oblivious. So then when we look back on it in, you know, what we call hindsight, then we start to say to ourselves, well, maybe I should have seen this coming. Now, when I look at it, there are all these signs that were being given off that I didn't read. So it's probably me, and therefore my ability to pick people is pathetic. I should have seen this coming. So the end result of that is a loss in trust of myself. At this point, I'm starting to think, well, my intuition should have spoken up. Maybe it did and I couldn't understand it or whatever it is. So the conspiracy here is that, and it's a conspiracy that I run against myself, is that I end up not trusting myself for something that I had no control over, because now I'm judging myself and saying that I should have seen it coming or taken protective action or whatever it is. And whatever that protective action might have been, whilst it saves or maybe save us from getting hurt anymore, there's no actual healing in it. And because there's no healing, then the stuff, so to speak, the damage, the baggage, gets buried. Eventually, we don't recognize it as anything important, and it sits down there in our subconscious, sending up behaviors that we find difficult to explain. And we start saying things like, oh, it's just the kind of person I am. And, you know, I'm not the sort of person who could start the dancing on the tables, or I'm, you know, introverted or extroverted or whatever it is. These are just descriptions of stuckness. They're not actually descriptions of how we are. They're descriptions of our reaction to something that we were not able to handle because we're too young and we weren't equipped to handle it. And then nobody came along recognizing that we were damaged and that we needed help. And in the light of that, then what happens is we don't heal. And that's probably the biggest problem in the whole thing, is that in the light of that, we don't heal. And so in many cases, that loss of self-trust creates an inability to trust self in future situations, in future, you know, it may be business deals or personal relationships or whatever it is. The loss of self-trust means an inability to actually think about trusting myself and running on gut feel or intuition or deciding something just based on my feelings, because I don't trust my feelings. And so that shows up as self-doubt, which, when you think about it, the most obvious thing to do in self-doubt is to procrastinate, because if I'm not sure what to do, well, the procrastination at least has the smell of not doing any further damage around it. Of course, it does. It creates massive damage, but at least it has that smell about it. So that's why we're attracted to it. And therefore, the problem becomes not really that we lost someone who used to be a dear friend or a partner or a mentor or a confidant or whatever, but the real loss is a loss of self as a dependable, reliable, and trusted advisor. Because when I can't trust me, when I can't lean on me, when I can't get a sense that my perception of something is actually how it might be, then what happens is I can't trust me, I can't run with me, I can't make decisions, I can't speak up, I can't do anything, because how do I know that I'm just not imagining the whole thing? And what that means is an inability to back myself. So I'm going to be reluctant to get into an argument where really I should be standing up for myself. I'm going to be reluctant to argue my point of view when really my point of view has some validity to it, no matter how much of a crazy I am. So what happens is that we back away from things rather than backing ourselves, simply because we don't have the confidence that we need to be able to step forward and say, I'm going in this direction, which is kind of crazy, but, you know, there it is. So when it comes to doing the work and looking at, well, what do we do about this? Then basically, you'll know that you're in victim mode. And really what I'm saying is none of us are victims, but we all end up in victim moments from, you know, four moments. We all end up playing the victim role for periods of time. How long we play that for really got a lot to do with our awareness and how much awareness we want to bring to what we're doing. So I'm by no means mean to call anybody on this call, this workshop, a victim, but we all step into it for periods of time. Thank goodness we step out of it as well. So when you're dwelling on how, you know, I was wrong and, you know, it was you that upset me, then we are definitely in the victim mode. The healing comes from when we gain detachment and say, what was going on here for both of us or all three of us or for this family or for this whatever. So when we can step out of our own suffering, then we stop being the victim. Many people find that incredibly difficult to do. Certainly, I've had plenty of battles with it over the course of my life. You also know that you're in victim mode when you're turning your pain into an ongoing drama. So, you know, my pain is bigger than yours. It goes on longer. It cuts deeper. It lasts longer, whatever you want to call that. And what that really is an overindulgence in our emotions, where our emotions become too important. You know, we lose track of the whole idea that our feelings are valid, but they are notoriously unreliable. And if you think about that, they're valid. Whenever you feel invalidated, it's when someone won't acknowledge that, you know, you are having the feeling that you are having, which is mostly what, you know, what we need to be able to move on and go, yeah, I was probably overindulging in that. I probably should come to my senses, etc. You also know that you're being in victim mode when it's difficult to plan and your behavior is erratic and you're not sure what to say and what to do or where to go or sometimes even where to stand. You might have seen someone wandering around sitting here and then standing up and moving over somewhere else and then sitting there and then moving over and walking around and picking up a plate and moving it from here to there. And that, you know, that erratic kind of no sense of direction kind of a thing. The healing comes when we make a plan for our own emotional recovery, when we figure out what we are going to do about it is when the healing takes place. And of course, you'll be in victim mode when you're not looking at the hole in your heart, you know, because generally speaking, what happens is this stuff hurts. And when it hurts, we feel empty inside. There's a great big cavern inside of us, you know, it's kind of like you could drive a truck in there. And the reality of that driving the truck in there is that we don't want to go and look at how big that hole is because it's a pretty scary thing. And when we look at how big that hole is, we kind of get a sense that, Jesus, if I go in there, I'm not sure if I'm coming out. Like that is a massive thing. So we don't want to look honestly at it because it has this sense that it could be way bigger than I have the capacity to handle. And yet, if we have the courage to feel that size of that hole, go inside it and grieve over whatever the loss is, we will fix it really quickly. But of course, not many, too many of us look at grieving as something that we're looking forward to doing. And, you know, we look at grieving as kind of pretty much, you know, how quickly can this end? How quickly can I get this over and done with? And if you've ever been around someone who's grieving, then your desire is to kind of, you know, like make them a cup of tea and settle them down and tell them everything's going to be all right and, you know, whatever, because we just don't know what to do because we acknowledge, you know, we know what that looking in that hole is like. And, you know, we tend to kind of get all wobbly about it when we're around someone who's grieving. Of course, you'll know you're in victim mode. This is the hardest one of all to tell, is that sometimes you can talk to the wrong people because, you know, you can be talking about your hurt and, you know, what's meaningful to you and maybe it's the size of that hole, But if you're talking to the wrong people, they just don't get it. And they just want to tell you to move on or to get over it or to grow up or whatever it is that they've got in their head would be good for you, which is mostly move away from them so that they're not so upset. But when we can find someone to confide in, that's when we're going to get healing. That's when we're going to feel like we are not so isolated and not so alone. And, you know, even if that person can't help us, at least they can listen to us and we can feel listened to and feel heard. And interesting enough, feeling heard turns out to be a critically important part of our well-being. You know, you're in victim mode when you're idealizing the past and saying, you know, this is all better when X, Y, Z, and, you know, we need to get back to the good old days, etc. You'll know you're in healing when you're looking forward to a better tomorrow, when you're figuring out, how do we make this better? How do I plan better? How do I act better? Those kind of things. Whilst we're being dominated by self-pity and regret about what we said or what we did and isn't it awful, then you're going to also know that you're in victim mode. And one of the things, one of the most important things we can do is say, how do I be of service to you? How do I help you? You know, because when we focus on someone else, and even if it's something as simple as going doing Meals on Wheels, the reality is that when we put ourselves into the act of service, we elevate ourselves because we make our own problems small and devote ourselves to helping someone who could benefit from that, particularly people who are not great at asking for it, you know, because there's a lot of people around us who, you know, not great at asking because it makes them feel like, you know, there's something lacking in them and they're not game and they don't want to admit that they're that fragile, those kind of things. So it can be tricky at that point. If we look at the bottom line, then pretty much what we need to point out here is that our interactions with other people, you know, we can't have betrayal without there being at least two people involved, probably more. Then essentially we can't have betrayal without two people. So let's take a classic situation that occurs in our culture to a frightening level, I might add. I just heard that 60% of police time in Australia is devoted to attending domestic violence. That's a staggering concept when you think about it. 60% of the time that our police spend actively policing is actually attending domestic violence. That sounds like two-thirds to me, or close to it. That's a staggering concept. So there's a lot of this going on that we, a lot more than we are comfortable to be aware of. I think otherwise we might do more about it. But then, nevertheless, if we kind of take the judgment out of that, every bully needs a victim and every victim needs a bully, and they seem to have an incredible ability to find each other. So what happens is that, like every match pair that I ever talk about, so when you do these workshops, you're gonna hear me talking about people who are involved in a relationship with each other which is designed to bring them to healing. So this match pair are actually attracted to each other because they have the potential to heal each other, but the problem is they won't be able to do that because they're too busy blaming the other one for their circumstances and their situation. You see, really what can happen here is that one day the victim could find the inner strength to stand up for themselves and refuse to be in this abusive situation. I'm not saying that that would be easy, but it is a possibility. It's certainly the thing that would be good for them to do. And if they do that, well, that gives them a chance to rise. Alternatively, you know, it's not a requirement or a responsibility to do that. Alternatively, the bully could actually one day address their own inner weaknesses and find within themselves a strength to deal with their demons. And in that case, realize that being a bully is just acting out their own fears and that they're equally as victimized as a victim. In fact, most bullies have been victims. So, you know, the research is very clear on that, is that most aggressors have been on the receiving end of aggression. So it's kind of like repeating the pattern. Well, that, you know, the bully could one day just say, you know, bugger this, I'm putting a stop to this and I'm no longer going to be violent as a way of coping with my own fears. So when you look at that, either one of these people could create a dramatic change. They may not be able to stay around each other because the victim is going to keep poking the bully with their victimhood so that the bully gets cranky and outraged and lashes out. by the same token, the bully's going to keep poking at the victim until, and so the victim acts out their victimhood. So it's kind of like, you know, maybe if one of them changes, they both have to change or they can't be together. And certainly I've seen that in many occasions. We've had clinical work where one member of a couple has decided, okay, that's it, enough. I'm not being like that anymore. And their partner had had the opportunity to change as well, but couldn't. So they had to separate. I've seen it on many occasions where one of the pair changes and the other one just automatically changes. It's kind of like there's this telepathic thing that goes on. So, you know, take that however you want. But essentially, whilst they stay in blame, there is no chance for them rising above the circumstances. So the key flag for us is when we're blaming somebody else. If we looked at it, then if we take this, you know, to the next level, then what happens if the victim does rise by finding their own, the inner strength that they thought they didn't have, is what they do is they change their life forever, theirs and possibly the bully's as well. But you see, they couldn't rise against nothing. If there wasn't something terrible going on, then they couldn't have got through it. So eventually they can conclude that the bully was actually the thing that saved the victim from themselves, because the victim was going to be a victim all the way along and never change their behavior, never change their attitude, never change their beliefs. It was a bully poking at them that got them to go, damn it, I've had enough of this. I'm rising against this. I'm overcoming this. And they stood up. And of course, standing up might have been a bit of an unpleasant, well, it would definitely be an unpleasant and very difficult thing to do. But when they do it, then they set themselves free. At that point, they have the opportunity to understand the bully was nothing more than a messenger from life itself urging them to stand up, urging them, you know, to say, look, you can do this. And when they do that, that gives rise to compassion. In other words, when we realize that the bully was sent to the victim for the victim to rise above, then the victim, who now has a totally changed life experience, suddenly turns out to be grateful to the bully for being the way they were and starts to find compassion and hopes that the bully can really get out of their torment and their horrible existence where everything's awful. I'm working with a client at the moment. In fact, I'm seeing her tomorrow, and we're only in our third session, and already, like in the second session, she said to me, this is exactly what's happened. Her husband, who's been, you know, enormously aggressive and abusive and alcoholic and a smoker for 40 years, she's finally said enough is enough. And with the work she's doing with me is in helping herself not want to go back and save him, because she's so grateful for him having been that awful that it caused her to rise above it. And she said, you know, if he hadn't been that bad, I would have stayed with him forever and never found my power. And I'm only 60 years old and I've got the next 20, 30 or 40 years to enjoy my life the way I want to. And I'm so grateful. And that's from a live person that I'm working with right now, saying 40 years, it could still work. Could still work. That's a tragedy when you think about it. But of course, the lesson for us is, here's this idea that forgiveness is kind of like a redundant concept, because in this case, she doesn't need forgiveness from him. She doesn't actually want, she doesn't want to be forgiven for anything that she did. She wants to extend forgiveness to him, but understands it's a redundant concept, because how can you be forgiving for somebody for something that they did that's turned you into a magnificent person? So she's gone from caterpillar to butterfly and wants to give credit where it's due, which is a staggering concept. So if we move all of that on, then we can say, okay, that takes a bit of work. That takes a bit of awareness. That takes a bit of realization. And for this client of mine, it's taken 40 years of agony. That's a lot of pain. We don't have to go for that long. So if you look at marriage takes effort, you'd have to say, well, you know, divorce takes a bit of effort as well. What I'm wanting to point out here is that we kind of say, oh, some of this stuff is hard. But, you know, what I want to point out to you is that whilst being in debt is hard and puts all sorts of strain on us and makes us feel weird and all the rest of it, being financially disciplined and saving up enough money so you end up with a savings and investment account, that's just as hard as being in debt. So they're equally as hard as each other. communication, when you think about it, you know, I've been married to Mary for 45 years, and I would say that communication is one of the most difficult things that we experience, and that's with all good heartedness coming towards it. But you know what? Not communicating is equally as difficult. It's equally as difficult lying in bed, unable to sleep because of a communication gone haywire. It's just as difficult. And my favorite one, obesity, actually is a constant battle. You know, for anybody who's overweight and doesn't like it, I'm actually going to change the word obesity to feeling heavier than you want to, because that's been my experience for a long time as well. It's feeling heavier than I want to. There's pretty much not a moment goes by in your day-to-day existence where you're not aware of that. You know, the fact that my pants don't do up as easily as they should, that the belt's gone out another notch, is a constant thing. It's not a once in the morning thing. It's there all of the time, getting hot and sweaty because I'm carrying too much weight. Nobody else is sweating, but I am, because of all that sort of, it's a constant battle. But you know what? Staying fit is a constant battle as well. Getting up and going to the gym is no less easy or more easy than being overweight. And what I'm saying, these things here, you know, we sort of say, who can be bothered? And I'm saying, well, you're going to have to be bothered whether you like it or not, that we have to put effort into our lives, whether we like it or not. Whether you're taking the positive view or the negative view, as far as effort is concerned, you're going to spend the same amount of energy either way. Therefore, up to us to choose. So on Saturday, I gave this exercise. Write these questions down or screenshot them or whatever, and tackle these at a time of your choosing, which for most people is never. You know, if this was to appear as a bunch of questions in a book, what we would do is we would immediately flick to the next page and keep reading and say, I'll do those questions later. But what I'm saying is, if you answer these questions sometime in the next week or so, and it's not hard to do because, you know, you'll be going for a walk around the block, or you'll be taking the dog for a walk, or you'll be going to the gym, or you'll be doing something where you could have a bit of brain space and you do not have to pull out your phone. You could actually take yourself through these three exercises. You know, when I go to the gym in the morning, I'm stunned at the number of people who can't be with themselves in the gym. They've got to turn the news on and watch that kind of rubbish. Or they listen to their phone, or they read whatever it is, take a book and read that or whatever it is, rather than be with themselves and get insight into themselves and have a breakthrough in their life. So I'm saying these questions are critically important, but I'm leaving you to do them. And I'm saying a wise person will address these questions and take the time that they need to be answered. So in what ways are you still playing victim? Is there a hole in your heart that you need to fill? Is there someone you need to forgive? Is there someone you need to beg forgiveness from? What do you need to write? Is there something you need to meditate on, meaning to sit with, to be still with? Is there a lesson still not learnt? How do you need to be different? When you answer those questions, you allow yourself to move forward. Take a deep breath and we'll move to abandonment. What I want to point out about these wrecks, whether you look at the houses or the cars, then in each case, these things have been abandoned by somebody who no longer saw any value in them. But of course, hot rodders would think that these things were gold, and people who like to renovate houses would think that those houses were gold as well. So the spirit is there. And I think that that's the greatest way to look at abandonment, is to say, because something is abandoned by the owner does not mean that it is without worth. And that is a critical message to get, does not mean that it is without worth. In fact, these cars and houses sitting in the paddock are actually probably gaining in worth the longer they sit there, because the older they become, then the less of them there are around, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So for abandonment, we're talking about being left and kind of forsaken. This word, forsake utterly, is kind of like, to me, that's out of a 17th century novel, to desert, to abandon one's farm. This is in the dictionary, by the way, to abandon the farm. Obviously, farms had greater value. To abandon one's child, to abandon a sinking ship, you know the story. So that's pretty much what we're talking about in terms of definition. But the thing about abandonment is that it's also something that we perceive as something that is done to us. In other words, betrayal gets done to us, abandonment gets done to us. We can be the innocent bystander, and therefore we feel like it's done to us. And done to us this time has a different message. This time, the feeling is predominantly that we are not worth sticking with, that abandonment has happened because we are lacking in value, that we don't have the whatever it would have been for people to stay with us. So abandonment has a completely different message to betrayal, even though they both feel like they are done to us by external forces. So that's an interesting difference. When we look at the feelings that come up, they are slightly different but include many of the same things. You'll see that there's a kind of a much more depowered version of emotions here. It is much more likely that in abandonment that we talk to people who are experiencing worthlessness and shame and insecurity. And you'll see that, you know, it's much less likely anger and those sort of things to turn up. Dismay is probably the common one. So those are the feelings which, like a kaleidoscope, can turn up at any time and probably going to be all mixed together and therefore very confusing to whoever is experiencing, because when we have more than one feeling, we try to decide which is the correct one, rather than realizing that they might all be correct and you might have a dozen of them running at once and you may have great difficulty articulating what you're feeling because it's actually a combination of a whole bunch of things that we don't have words for. Instantly, what abandonment creates is dismay. It's probably the first cab off the rank. We tend to go searching for reasons why, as if we could name it, that would make it easier to experience. Naming and shaming, as with betrayal, happens. Shock is obviously out there. Outrage can be a big one. So these things can continue in a similar term. Longer-term reactions, and remember, those short-term things can persist for a long time. But longer term, then the big one is a feeling of not being lovable or worthless. So the sense of worthlessness, because otherwise they would have stayed instead of leaving me. That, of course, creates the idea that perhaps more abandonment is likely. The way that we prevent abandonment is by pushing other people away and not getting involved. So that, you know, shows up as the inability or the unwillingness to commit again. And even if we do, to expect the worst. Some people have the compulsion to leave first. If they think the relationship is in trouble, then they're going to leave first because then they don't get left. That's really, it's kind of like an incredible thing. It's easier to inflict pain than it is to wear the pain. This is a tragic thing about us, is that we're so hopeless at wearing pain that we would rather inflict it than wear it, which is a tragic kind of a thing when you think about it. Some people turn themselves into people pleasers because they figure that way they won't get left. A version of that can be over-delivering, either at work or at home or both. And of course, you know, raging insecurity and a codependency. Many couples end up hanging on to each other, telling each other, I love you, I'll never leave you, all that sort of stuff. And that's got a lot to do with, I finally found somebody who won't leave me and therefore I can feel more secure. It's kind of a tragic thing. And of course, mood swings are going to turn up because having someone who says they won't leave you is fine, but they might die or they might get in a car smash or whatever it is. So we can't actually predict the future. So mood swings are likely to be big on the thing there. These things, of course, are going to show up, particularly the feelings of not being lovable, not being worthwhile, and having to earn our place in the world. That's going to show up as a compulsion rather than a feeling. And what I mean by a compulsion is something that's just overwhelmingly just, you know, it's a kind of a craving to do the thing that we need to do to make it happen. Really, the core issue boils down to is abandonment hit so hard that we assume that we better protect ourselves because it might happen again in the future. And as a consequence of that, you know, the thing that kind of makes all of that happen is that we are assuming that we won't survive that much pain again. And when you think about it, it's probably a reasonable assumption to make, is that that level of pain hurt so much the first time I thought I was going to die. So why wouldn't the second time around take me out just as bad, and probably that would take me over the edge? And so most people are consumed with the idea that the same kind of pain again will be more unbearable than the first time. Our experience working in this field every day is that actually second time around it's a lot easier to handle because you handle it once and it won't hit so hard. So that's not the assumption that people make. So interesting concept, the conviction that I'm not worth being with. Whoops, sorry about that. I've touched the wrong button, so I've got to make the screen come back again. must be meant to see it again. So the convictions are not worth being with may actually have nothing to do with events and circumstances that we live through, but the conviction is still going to persist. In other words, we may feel that we were abandoned when we weren't. Say, for example, my dad going to work 7 in the morning, coming home at 7 at night. Obviously, I would have loved more time with him and loved his company, particularly as I got older. So his perception was that he was working harder to give me more. So I had some toys that other kids didn't have. So I was probably, you know, well looked after in terms of material objects, those kind of things. So my feelings of being abandoned have got nothing to do with what actually happened. They've got to do with my interpretation of what actually happened. And so what I lived through kind of, you know, takes second place to the conclusions I've come to. So that conclusion creates that I'm unlovable, otherwise he would be here, he would turn up, or she would, or whatever it is. So we engage ourselves in protective measures which are designed to stop us from getting hurt more, but really what happens is they don't heal us. And because they don't heal us, nothing changes, and therefore that creates disasters later in life. And it's one of those things where we can head full bore into something that we can see is going to turn out to be an absolute, totally unmitigated disaster, and still find ourselves unable to pull ourselves up because the compulsion that says I have to do this because things aren't right if they're not. So that compulsions get to be amazing things. That inability to believe that we are truly loved, well, what happens is loneliness and isolation are my experience, despite the fact that I'm surrounded by evidence to the contrary. It's a staggering concept, is that there are people in this world who are loved. You know, there are people who would take a, you know, any of you who are parents would probably take a bullet for your child. Your child probably has no sense of that in terms of how serious you are about that, because there's no day-to-day demonstration of that. So it doesn't appear an obvious thing. Therefore, the convictions of unworthiness can persist. And that becomes a conclusion about the truth. In other words, you start to say, well, that's actually it is how it is. And what that means is that there's an inability to sustain close relationships over any period of time. So the core issues turn out to be an inability to believe that we're actually loved, loneliness and isolation, despite the fact we're surrounded by people, convictions of unworthiness, regardless of what we achieve, and an inability to sustain close relationships, because they seem to somehow put the torch to them. Those core issues are pretty, pretty important. Unfortunately, it's not the end of the story. The next cab off the rank is that another core issue, I'm saying, is our self-loathing that leads to poor self-parenting. And so, you know, when we don't like ourselves enough, then it's very difficult to do the things that would represent self-care, self-respect, self-love, those kind of things. They become very, very difficult to do. Of course, it leads to absolutely horrible decision making. And that, of course, leads to very poor self-care as well. It kind of reinforces it. And self-esteem just hits rock bottom at that point. Very difficult to rescue the whole thing. And, you know, this person ends up with very poor results in the parts of their life that really matter. So this person could be extraordinarily successful in their business and feel like it doesn't count. They could be extraordinarily successful in their relationships and feel like it doesn't count. So it just depends on what matters to them. And what I'm saying is that for all of us, if we don't heal abandonment, then what happens is that we can be surrounded by massive success that we ourselves have generated, but they don't count. They don't make us feel better. But what is the work? Well, in this case, the work needs to be deep. And of course, here's our friends again. So this time, instead of calling them victim and bully, I'm calling them abandoned and abandoner. But basically what you need to do is understand there can be any kind of version of a matched pair. What we need to do is in a meditative state. In other words, you've got to wait till you get yourself in the right state. That's via meditation or yoga or walking in the park or sitting on the beach or whatever, but, you know, take your book and pen with you and look at the abandonment. Now, I say recall. Maybe you have to imagine, maybe you have to remember, but just take yourself through the events of the situation as you recall them. And as you've done that, then identify the conclusions that you formed about yourself. Don't worry about who left you and who dumped you and all the rest of it. What is the conclusion that you came to about yourself in the light of that event happening? That's the thing we've got to get onto. Once you've identified those feelings, and like I said, it's predominantly going to be unworthiness, then it's our job to welcome those feelings in, because it's not until we run the risk of allowing that to actually be the truth, that we are completely worthless. It's not until we run the risk of doing that, that we are absolute, that we can ever hope to be healed. Therefore, what we have to do is we have to sit with those feelings until those feelings dissipate. Because until they dissipate, then they're still going to run us. They're still going to run our life. They're still going to make us do things that dismay us when we do them. You know, we have a right to be dismayed at the words and deeds of some of the people in our lives, but not as much as we are dismayed by the words and deeds that we do to ourselves. You know, if you're looking for the culprit, then stand in front of a mirror and you've found the person who's done the most damage to you. So maybe what you need to do is write to the person who left you. This is not a letter for posting. This is for you to do the work on yourself. Therefore, it's important that it expresses your feelings. If it's a letter that just expresses what happened, if it's a retelling of the event, then it's basically a waste of your time. So it needs to get to the feelings. And then you've got to find a way to express those feelings. Whether you sing them, whether you paint them, whether you draw them, it doesn't matter. You can write them, you can talk them, it doesn't matter. But you need to get it out of your system via some method of expression, which is why we say sing, paint, draw. I should say sing, paint, draw, write, talk. And then do what you can to experience life from the abandoner's point of view. Take a walk in their shoes. Maybe we will find a different experience. Maybe we'll find understanding. We perhaps might even find compassion. And then, of course, the thing to do is to look for your lesson in that, because it must be true that the abandoner, yeah, sure, they did the wrong thing. But what is a lesson? What is a life lesson for you to get so that you can grow? So I'm saying, what is a lesson to get so that you can grow? Otherwise, this thing has gotcha and it's going to keep continuing to control your life by sending up behavior that you wish was different and which you will every now and then tackle with, you know, weird ass things to try and make yourself be different. When you're done, express gratitude to the person who perpetrated the event upon you, because until you're expressing gratitude for them bringing it to you, then you ain't got it. You don't understand it. There's an exercise for you to do as well. And this is, once again, answer these questions in your own time at your own pace. Take your time with them. But I'm going to suggest to you that if you don't set aside some time in your diary for you to be on your own and sit down and answer these questions in writing, then you're not really serious about healing yourself, because here it is. Here's a recipe for you to go through the process that will heal you. This will save you about $4,000 a day, because that's what it costs to get me. Well, it costs about $4,000 to get me for half a day. So I could come and do these questions with you, and it would cost you $4,000 for me to ask you what's sitting right in front of you right at the moment. All you've got to do is jot those questions down or screenshot them, and then take yourself somewhere private and commit to staying there long enough to answer these questions in such a way that you will be healed by doing the work. What is doing the work? The work is not finding the answers. The work is feeling the feelings while you're discovering the answers. I can't make it any more powerful than that. We do need to move on, though. We're burning up time like crazy. So let's go to broken trust. Broken trust, if we look at definition of it, then it's a reliance on the integrity or the strength or the surety of a person or of a thing who promised you that they were going to be there or do whatever they said that they were going to do or whatever it is. So trust is actually an agreement. And that's why the breaking of a trust is such a powerful thing for us, is because basically it's in thin air. We can have a contract, but most contracts are written in such a way that we realize that someone is probably going to try and break the contract. So we write the contract in as many different ways as we can. And so we're about to sign a contract for the sale of our farm down in Canberra. Hopefully that'll happen in the next week or so. And that document will be 50 pages thick when it needs to be one, because the one page should say, we sell and they buy, this is the agreed price. The other 49 pages are other ways of saying, we sell, they buy, and this is the agreed price. So why do those contracts exist? Because so many people try to get out of a contract rather than let their word be their bond. They've got their reasons for that, but you know what happens is people get their trust broken and you know all the damage happens there. So we feel cheated because we were doing our part of it. You know, the offer we've taken on our house is lower than somebody else offered. So we're placing more trust in the person that we're selling to from the point of view of we think they're a better, more solid operator and the deal won't fall over. So if the deal fell over, then we're going to be very angry with them. We're going to feel very brokenhearted about us trusting them when they said they can come up with the money and then we discover that they can't. Of course, there will be some kind of excuse like the bank or this or that or the other, but nevertheless, the broken trust will be there. So that's why contracts have all these out clauses, that kind of stuff. So once again, what a broken trust does is it causes us to doubt our ability to pick other people because, you know, we have looked at this couple who have bought our house and said to ourselves, they look pretty solid, you know, they're nice people, all of that sort of stuff. So we get, you know, all over the place about it. When trust is broken, then there's enormous range of emotions that can surface. These shouldn't surprise you. Confusion is usually top of the list because, you know, that's how come you've changed your mind. I don't understand. Or I committed. How come you aren't? Blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. You'll see these things are not difficult to understand. But the one that hasn't been on the other list is dread. I think anxiety probably wasn't on the list as well. Dread is that fear that, you know, something terrible is going to happen and that we're going to have to go through the whole disaster again. And, of course, closely related to that is alarm. Like I have said twice already, these emotions are likely to happen all at once. And because of them being likely to happen all at once, then we get them all mixed up and we go into a bit of confusion around that as well. What are the common instant reactions? Well, these are probably not going to surprise you. They are a blend of what we see in the others. The self-doubt was there before, but now it's rising. Dismay, of course, outrage, hurt, indignation. Naming and shaming has been present in all three of them. Shock, etc. You know, you shouldn't be too surprised about that. What are the longer-term reactions? Continuing loss of faith in self is the most common. Outrage can go for 30, 40, 50 years. So, you know, don't expect to be the beneficiary of calming down unless you do something about that. Of course, an unwillingness to trust again makes sense. People become wary. Many people are carrying a torch about something that happened many, many years ago and can't let go of it. That turns into, the outrage turns into bitterness and eventually resentment. Those things just eat away at us. Then we have difficulty handling agreements that are not all in writing and stipulated and whatever. There's hyper alertness and the expectation of disappointment. Those are the longer term things. In terms of what are the core issues? Well, because trust calls into question our original decision about that person's character, then we're going to go more in the direction of self-doubt. That should make sense. And then the result of that is because I don't trust myself, I start to look outside of myself and I start to trust people who have got no idea or are not familiar with my circumstances or don't know about my preferences, and I make some pretty shocking decisions and away we go from there. And it reinforces that whole idea that I didn't see it coming, so it's equally likely that that I won't see it coming again. And that therefore I need to protect myself and that, you know, I'm just even more in loss of self-trust on account of, you know, this disaster happening in the first place. So in many cases, broken trust equals a loss of self-trust and inability to trust self. That's really the biggest damage. That's really the biggest problem. And that shows up for most people, or in the majority of cases, if that's a better way to say it, as self-doubt, leading to chronic procrastination, because at least if I don't say or do anything, maybe I won't get it wrong. And as I said before, you know, this sentence here, this black sentence in the bottom of the page there, you've seen that sentence earlier in this presentation. that's because this is so powerful. The greatest loss is not the loss of a dear friend or a confidant, a partner, a mentor, or whatever, but the loss of self as a dependable, reliable, and trusted advisor. Because when we have ourself as that trusted advisor, someone we can rely on, someone who's dependable, someone that we can turn to, then we're never lonely. And the lack of it translates into an inability to back ourselves, to, you know, put money behind our decisions, to go places and do things that we think would be a good idea. And the problem with that is that then we're just full of self-doubt. We don't remember what to do. So what is the work? Well, hopefully you remember our diagram. So if that's the case, then the work boils down to who broke your trust and in what way. What decision did you make about yourself? How have you compensated for that? Are you still carrying any resentment, bitterness, anger? What do you need to write and who do you need to write it to? Remember, don't mail it. Is there something you need to meditate on and spend some time on? Is there a lesson you still got to get? Is there behavior you need to change? Do you trust too easily or not trust enough? And who do you need to forgive? Especially make sure you include yourself on that list. So there's a fair bit of work to do there. So you can understand everything that we've talked about, but if you don't do the work, nothing happens. So you can think that this is one of the smartest presentations you've ever seen. Hopefully you do. It's pretty cluey. It's taken a bit of working out. But if you don't do the work, then nothing happens. So the work, as far as all three heartbreakers is concerned, there's a fundamental truth that we have to go with, is you have to honor your emotions. You have to remind yourself constantly that your emotions are valid, but they're notoriously unreliable. Something else completely could be going on, but your feelings are your feelings. So feel them deeply, feel them thoroughly, and get ready to dump them, because maybe you kind of made it up. So yes, your emotions are real and they are valid at both at the same time. And no, they're not reliable. They're not factual. They're not even a good representation of what actually took place under the circumstances that you heard about. Therefore, it's critically important that you understand your capacity, willingness, to even your determination to make it all up as you go along, and then convince yourself that your wild fantasizing has some relationship to the truth. Now, that's a big sentence, but it's probably the most powerful one. You need to understand it's critical to your well-being that you understand you have a massive capacity to make it all up as you go along, and then convince yourself that your wild fantasizing that you made up has something to do with the truth, when probably it's only got a little bit to do with the truth. Therefore, this fundamental necessity for you is that we have to make healing time. Your baggage isn't going away, and it's not going to stop controlling yourself. What's going to happen is that your baggage will be less obvious. The cause of your baggage will be less obvious, and you'll have more and more rationalizations for why you are the way that you are. The better that you can explain why you're a perfectionist, or the better you can explain why the opposite of a perfectionist, the more you've rationalized it and the more it's controlling you, and you've had to find a reason to explain it instead of simply changing. Its grip has just got stronger. So most people make the mistake of assuming that all that hurt and damage that was done early in their lives has kind of magically morphed somewhere. It's kind of gone away, you know, and we have things like time heals all wounds, and that one of three possibilities has happened. One, it's fixed itself just by the passing of time. And if you could show me something that fixed itself, well, I'd love to see that. You know, like a car that reassembled itself one day, a broken car, of course, or a house that fell down and then just stacked itself back up together again. I'd love to see that. So the concept of it healing itself over time, you know, borders on ridiculous. So that's why I call it a fantasy. The other possibility is that we think that it's, you know, it's responding to our management technique. So it's actually a good idea that I don't let myself get close to people anymore and form deeper, more trusting relationships, because that saves me from getting hurt again. That's a concept that's ridiculous as something fixing itself, but we believe it. We figure, oh yeah, that's working. And of course, the big one, the one that we just never really come to terms with until we fundamentally drop our bundle, is that we think that it's going to stop sending up behavior that we hate about ourselves. And every time you do something about yourself that you dislike or feel you could do better, it has to be this stuff. It has to be this unhealed baggage. And the fact that you can't put your finger on what it is simply means, you know, ring your coach, talk to someone who can help. But for goodness sake, don't stop looking. That's the problem, is that most people stop looking. This stuff is essential to our self-trust. You have to follow your inner guidance. Of course, following your inner guidance means that you're going to make mistakes. But life is not about not making mistakes. Life is actually about making mistakes, because if you make mistakes, you can fail your way to success. You see, your intuition is never going to start speaking to you in ways that you can understand if you continually ignore what it's telling you. And it's trying to talk to you by creating these dramas in your life. Now, it's true that along the way, you're going to confuse your intuitive feelings with your baggage urging you to do one thing or another, because intuition and baggage speak the same language, which is impulses and sensations and feelings. But over a period of time, you can work out the difference if you're willing to apply yourself. What you have to do is you have to give yourself enough opportunity to be able to work out the difference between your intuition and your baggage speaking, because when you do, the world becomes your oyster. Therefore, the most important daily activity that you could undertake is to start to take risks, because that way your comfort zone is not going to shrink in around you. You see, if success actually equals failing your way forwards until you get there, well, then risk-taking is actually an essential tool in developing you into your full potential. That should make sense. The trouble is, most of us need it tattooed on our forehead backwards so that we could read it in the mirror, because really what it says is, yes, you've got to get used to failing so that you can fail your way towards success. Most of us want advice about our decisions because we're afraid of making the wrong decision. But the wrong decision is often the fastest way to find out what the right decision is. And sometimes the people we go to advice not qualified to give it. Therefore, we have to change our relationship with failure. And that's a concept that most people are not going to embrace. They won't let it happen, because they just fear being wrong. In amongst your daily activities, you have to define what self-care is for you, because if you don't know what it is, then you can't administer it. So it's a kind of essential that you figure out what self-care represents for you, whether that's more yoga or less yoga, whether that's more goji berries or less goji berries, whether that's whatever it is. But if you don't get whatever that is into your timetable, then the truth is, if it's not in your timetable, you don't care, mate. Telling me that you're getting around to it won't cut the mustard. I just know you're not doing it. And I know you're not doing it because it doesn't matter enough to you. So until you make self-care entries into your diaries as the first thing that you do, then you're just fooling around the edges of personal development, hoping that if you do a little bit, you'll get a long way. And hoping that if you do the bits that don't hurt, you can still have all the benefits. And I'm here to say that's tragically bad news. That ain't going to happen. If you want the results of personal development, then you'll have to do the work. Just like someone who comes to me and says, can I be an Olympic swimmer? I have to say to them, it's possible, but you'll have to get in the pool. And you'll have to get in the pool more than once. And you'll have to get in the pool when you'd rather vomit. In fact, you probably have to get in the pool despite the fact that you're vomiting. Therefore, it's imperative to feel the emotions that arise around extending self-care, the guilt, the shame, the lack of time, and put those feelings to bed. You absolutely must commit to standing up for yourself, because if you don't, No one else. There's nobody coming to do that for you. Now, of course, at first glance, that looks like I'm recommending that you sail headlong into a bunch of conflict and don't worry about it and just bash up everybody you come in contact with. In fact, I'm saying the opposite of that. Whilst maybe that's a possibility in the future, this strategy is not about that. This strategy is about not abandoning you. That's the key here. You just got to make your values important enough to you for you to take a stand for them, especially when you're dealing with yourself. Remember, all these people who've hurt and damaged you have done nothing compared to the hurt and damage that you have done to you. If you want to find the culprit, time to go and visit the mirror again. We look at the bottom line. Essentially, a tortoise shell is a protective device. Turns out to be its home. Poor little bugger can't get out of there. It's got to carry its home everywhere it goes. Looks like a grey nomad traveling around Australia, dragging its home with it behind a four-wheel drive. But it's a very safe place in there. But if we stay safe, we're going to starve to death. And this fella, if he doesn't stick his neck out at some point, going to starve to death. And that's the reality of us stepping out. Therefore, we can say that the thing that drives trust is vulnerability and risk. Just think of the tortoise, vulnerability and risk. They're the things that drive trust. But, and it's a big but it's easy to understand, it's our perceptions and our beliefs that drive the drivers. If you get that, it's all pretty straightforward. You can download the worksheets from our website. Hopefully you want to do that. It's one of the ways of going through the material and one of the three or four ways that you can do that to lock it in. So I'm going to recommend that to you with my highest level recommendation, and that you also go and download from the members site the evaluation sheet that you can do and whereabouts you are in all of those situations. Give yourself a score. There's no other organization on the planet that I know that produces this level of self-evaluation that gives you some sense of plotting where you are. And of course, you could think about continuing the journey. So we are next together right now, 16th of November. That's what we're doing, next day Q&A. But following that, we are doing our next session is on judgment. If you want to join us from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Sydney time, then the venue for me is at 3 Harrigan's Lane, Jacob's Well, but for you, it's at your place because we'll be doing it by Zoom again. Meanwhile, you can jump on to the Facebook group and log in there and talk about your progress or lack thereof. You can talk about things that are going well, things that are not going well. Get a chance for some coaching from me if that's what you would like, and we'll be only too pleased to see you do that. So let me bring those things up onto the screen again. It's probably the thing that's most important. Involvement matters. You know, when you're doing this kind of duck onto that Facebook group and share what's going on for you, then you are committing time to yourself as well as to everybody else. So that's it for me, gang. I've gone over time, so I'm going to take the opportunity to not take questions at this point because of out of respect for your time. But I do understand that being with us on this occasion is an allocation of your time, and that's the thing you have least of in the world. So thank you for being with us. Good night. God bless. See you soon.
Good night, Paul, and thank you.
Good night.